This is the You Can Learn Chinese podcast, part of the Seneca Network from the China Project. For everyone who's trying to learn Chinese or reaching for the next level, you came to the right place. I am your host, Jared Turner, co-founder of the Mandarin Companion Graded Reader Series. And before I learned Chinese, I thought it was pretty cool how Chinese people made a language entirely out of tattoos. My co-host is John Paston, co-founder of Mandarin Companion, founder of All Set Learning, the Chinese Grammar Wiki, Sinospice.com, and one of the darkest times in his life was when he forgot to pay his electric bill. Today, John and I are talking about how to optimize note-taking for language learning to maximize your learning gains. Guest interview is with Nick Anderson, cross-cultural consultant and Chinese accent coach in Hollywood. Let's get to it.
Hey everybody, you're listening to You Can Learn Chinese. I am one of your hosts. My name is John Paston. I am based in Shanghai, China.
And this is Jared Turner joining us from Utah here in the United States.
I was just in the States, Jared, visiting family in Atlanta, and it was pretty good to be back, let me tell you.
Now, this was your first time back to the States in what, 3 years or something?
Yeah, about 4 years, I think.
Holy cow. Did you kiss the ground when you got here?
No, but it's been too long for sure, yeah.
Glad to be back in the Shanghai?
Yeah, glad to be back. A little bittersweet, I guess. I still like China, but yeah, it had been too long since I visited family in the U.S., so that was a good trip for sure.
Well, I'm hoping I can make it back out to China this year, but, you know, we'll see.
Come on out, Jared. Foreigners are getting few and far between, let me tell you. After COVID, a lot of people have taken off.
Things, they be changing, but we still be learning Chinese.
Okay, so today we're going to get into a topic that relates to pretty much anyone who's studying Chinese. Whether you're studying one-on-one with a tutor, studying on your own, studying in a small class, large class, pretty much anyone trying to learn a language, they need to take notes. But one of the things I've noticed is that a lot of people aren't really sure about the best way to take notes. You know, what really works the best? Does it really vary a lot from person to person? So today we want to dive into this topic and talk about quite a few different angles.
So I'm going to say this real quick, John. I'm going to kind of append a little something there that you need to take notes. You don't have to, but I think taking notes is definitely advantageous.
All right.
Now, before we jump into this, John, I think it's important to note something here. That we can talk about notes in the respect of like actually writing it down, paper, pencil, or pen, analog notes, right? So you're writing it down physically versus taking digital notes. Now, I know, John, you're a bit more on the side of the fence of, hey, you like to actually write it down by hand.
Well, actually, Jared, I haven't written down notes in years. I don't do that anymore. But if someone is just starting to learn Chinese and they ask me, they're a beginner, then I'm going to tell them, you should write by hand. You should have a notebook on paper that you use your hand to create notes with, because that really does work better. Studies have shown it, especially as a beginner, when you're like really learning those tones, that pinyin, like forcing yourself to actually write out the letters, create that tone mark and see the contour as you write it. I think it helps imprint the information in your brain better.
I definitely think there's some benefits in there. But for those of us who are like, I don't care about research, I think notes are important, but I'm just going to, you know, type it into my notes or something here on my phone. We have people in that camp as well. Maybe we hit things from both ends.
Well, I think that it is normal, though, that beginners will get the most benefit from writing by hand, and that most of those people will switch over to digital notes at some point. I do know a few, like I have some clients at All Set Learning. They're quite advanced, but they insist on writing by hand because they want to be able to write every character by hand. But, you know, that's not everybody, obviously.
Yeah, and that's a whole nother discussion.
All right, so are we ready to get into some principles of note-taking?
Let's do it.
All right, so number one is that you're taking notes to help you learn, to help you remember stuff. It's not that you're trying to reconstruct everything you've ever learned about the language or, you know, making your own personal dictionary with every word you've ever learned. Like, that's not what you're doing. You're trying to just help the things that you need to remember to stick. And so sometimes people take notes and they don't even look at them again, but the act of taking the notes has helped them. And hopefully they've been focusing on the things that they most need to learn as they're taking notes.
This is very true, because there's a lot of times you're in a conversation, you're reading something, you just, whatever it is, you encounter some new element of the language. And right at that moment, oh, it's really salient. It's really relevant to you. And you kind of think, oh, that's great. And, you know, I'm not going to forget this now, but you just might. You probably will. And this is the perfect time, right, to write that down. And it's so true. It's like sometimes I write a reminder for myself to do this thing, but simply that act of writing that reminder negates the actual need for that reminder because
exactly.
It does something to you.
Or you might be in a case where you're like in a Chinese class and your teacher is super boring, but because you're forcing yourself to take notes, you're actually listening. Whereas if you weren't taking any notes, you'd just be staring off into space, right?
I think it gives a little bit of intentionality to our learning. And in fact, there's recently I ran across a paper. It was talking about incidental versus explicit learning. You know, the difference being, you know, incidental, you're just picking up things without really trying, and kind of like extensive reading, versus the intentional aspect where, hey, I'm deliberately trying to learn this. And really, we learn best with both methods. You know, just simply that act of note-taking, it introduces an element of intentional learning, even though if you might be passively picking something up, but also combined with that intentional aspect, it's going to allow that to solidify and stick in your brain.
Okay, so principle one, the act of taking notes helps you learn. It's not necessarily what's in the notes. It's the taking that really helps you. All right, so now principle two, I think it's really useful to follow some standard formats or some kind of conventions in your notes. I mean, obviously you don't have to, and you're not going to have it when you first start. But like one thing I used to do is when I would take vocabulary notes, I would always start with the characters, then put the pinyin in parentheses and put the English on the right side. I might even do like a column thing so I could review straight from my notes by covering up the English or covering up the pinyin. I would also do this thing where if I knew I had it that in that order, characters, pinyin, English, and I didn't know the characters or I couldn't get them in time, I would just write blanks and then the pinyin, and then later on I'd fill in the characters. So I've known people who do like color coding in their notes. And, you know, just having some kind of standard format just helps you make sense of them later.
I think this is a great thing because otherwise, if you don't have some sort of standard format, it can be a mess. I mean, you can make sense out of it, but it takes a little bit more mental effort to decode your own notes. Right there, I'm not even talking about what your handwriting might look like, which, who knows, could look like lightning struck an ink bottle. It's really important to make sure you have some sort of standard format so it makes sense to you and others as well.
Others? Why is that important?
You might have a tutor. I mean, maybe you've got a friend taking the same class. I don't know, whatever.
All right, but I think, you know, if you want to review your notes, the chances are much greater if you do follow some kind of format or convention. Because otherwise, you're just wasting too much time trying to figure out what you wrote. Quick summary. Use some kind of standard formats or conventions in your notes. It'll help make them clearer for you. All right, so are you ready for principle three?
Let's do it.
Okay, this one is consider reorganizing and maybe even rewriting your notes in some cases. So it's about organization.
You know, I guess you could just take all of your notes and just put it in some document, right? Maybe you're, and let's assume at this point you're following some of the standard convention. Okay, I'm doing the character, pinyin, whatever. But if it's just dumped in a document, you don't have a whole lot of organization to go off of, and it's going to take you, again, a lot more cognitive brain power to just kind of start filtering through that and realizing, oh, what was this, a grammar point? Or where was that one word? Or how can I organize it? How can I look through this and figure it out?
Yeah, and sometimes when you reread your notes, you realize that you don't totally understand some of the things you wrote. So maybe you want to, like, you know, highlight that or like move it to another section, you know, copy it to tomorrow's notes so that you ask the teacher about it.
And John, I would say that I think this is a great case for having the digital, the digital note taking, because a lot of these programs, you can really reorganize these things very easily. You can start classifying them, and sometimes you can search through them, which can be really helpful.
You say that like it's a pro, but I gotta say it's also a con, because I've known quite a few people who spend way too much time organizing their notes. You know, categorizing their flashcards, reformatting the grammar points. Like, is that really useful? Like, are you really learning anything from that? I mean, to a certain extent, you will. But when you spend too much time on it, Then you got to start wondering if it's really the best use of your study time.
It's so true. It's that procrastination trick of you know, instead of actually doing the task you need to do, you like go clean your room, right? It's
organize.
There you go. So we definitely got to make sure that doesn't become a distraction from your learning. But I will say on this aspect too, I think when we're talking about organizing and rewriting notes, whether it's by hand or digitally, I think it's very important to also start at this time discriminating which ones are really important for you to start learning and which ones are not. And it's like pruning a tree or a bush. If you're an advanced learner, maybe this isn't as important, but especially when you are as early stages and even getting into your intermediate stages, is you're going to come across stuff that's just out there and you maybe ran across in this one special instance, but that's not critical for you to learn right now. And so pruning that and really making sure instead of, you know, oh, I got 700 new words, well, maybe you should focus on 100 right now because you're probably not going to pick up all 700 of those.
Yeah, that's something that can happen a lot if, like, you're living in China, you have a one-on-one tutor, right? Is that what you're thinking of, Jared?
I mean, yeah, there's that. But, you know, it's just if you are enthusiastic about learning the language, you're going to be out there looking for things, reading things, trying to have some sort of conversation. So you're also going to be encountering new words, hopefully. I hope you are, based on your efforts.
Right.
But it's going to be important to prune those things as well and make sure you stay focused. And it's not to say that these things you're pruning out that you never come across them again, but make sure you focus on these things that are more relevant to you right now. And maybe you're taking those other ones, the ones you're pruning off, you have, like, you know, maybe putting them in different buckets, if you will. Like, oh, this is something I encountered when I was doing this activity or whatever. So if I get involved in that, it's great to come back to some of these words.
All right. And one other comment about reorganizing. I have found that if you're writing by hand, it's never going to get out of hand. Like, you're not going to rewrite your notes 5 times. Like, no one does that. But you might spend way too long reorganizing your notes when they're digital. All right, let me just throw that out there.
A very good point. So principle 3, consider reorganizing and rewriting your notes. And I would even advocate pruning those when necessary.
All right. So principle 4, your notes are not your textbook and they're also not a dictionary, but how are those different? Like, what are your notes? You know they're for you. You know that the act of taking them is helping you learn. But how can you take notes so that they're actually more useful to you personally? This is something that you can be thinking about as you take notes to help them be more effective. So to give an example of that, I remember when I was in the early stages of learning Chinese and I would write out the pinyin and add the tone mark. You know, don't forget to add the tone marks. And I would make the tone marks extra big because I was so bad at tones and I was always forgetting them. But by making them bigger, it was easier to review. And I was just trying my best to imprint those tones harder, you know, by making them larger.
Some people like to doodle, draw pictures. Some people, you know, if you got the character, there might be different elements of the character that you specifically remember. You know, like the radicals, components is what we really should say, right? But, you know, there's the San Dian Shui, which is the three little dots for water. There's little elements that are related to the character, where you encountered it, the situation, a person, the location that might help you to remember these different words or grammar elements that you're encountering and that you're writing down as notes. Any of those things that can provide you more context and provide more of a foundation for you can potentially be beneficial and helpful to you in remembering and ultimately really acquiring these new words and things that you're running across.
Yeah, that's a great example. I'm glad you brought up the character component thing, because I remember when I was in school learning Chinese as a beginner, like, a lot of people would fill up their notebooks with lines and lines of just writing the same characters over and over. But I really did not like that kind of rote writing practice. And so I would often put in my notes, like, the character breakdowns. Like, what are the actual parts of this character? You have to understand the structure. And then what is this component? I've never looked it up before. And I would actually draw these breakdowns in my notes. And if I could make some sense out of it, because, you know, sometimes the characters just make sense and sometimes they really don't. And sometimes I'd, like, draw little pictures of little stories to help me remember. A little bit like the Heisig method, but a bit more haphazard. But even if I just drew the little story once in my notes and never looked at it again, it still helped me remember the character.
And John, I'm glad you brought up the Heisig method, because I was actually thinking about this as you were talking about it. It's a method to help you remember characters And, you know, it can be used for other things as well, but you kind of take that character. And I'm really not super familiar with the method, John, so you'll forgive me and anyone listening, because there's a lot of people know a lot better than I do. But it's, you know, you're taking that character and you're now associating it with like a scene, like with a movie or different things that you're familiar with. And so if you are applying that method, taking notes can be very helpful to help you really remember that character.
Okay, so to sum up, just try to make your notes personalized for you because, hey, they are for you. And the more you do that, the more they're going to stick. Okay, and then the final principle, principle number 5, is something from some of my own experience, which is try to include the lessons that you've learned from mistakes. Like one of the things that I used to like to do is I would think about how to say something in Chinese, but I wasn't sure the correct way to say it. And so I'd write out my guess. And maybe I have two guesses. I bet it's either this way or this way. Like maybe I looked up two different words in a dictionary, or maybe I was trying different grammar or didn't know whether to put le or not, you know, that kind of thing. And then I would have my lesson, I would ask the teacher, and I would find out which one was right, why this one is wrong, and then I would write that into my notes. So I went to the effort of writing the sentences myself, and then I went back and I corrected them and explained them. And because I did both of those things on paper in my notes, it really helped that lesson stick for me.
John, I think I'm glad you're bringing this up. This is, I think, really important even beyond language learning is knowing how not to do something can almost be as important as knowing how to do something. Because if you know the right way to do something, but you don't know the wrong way, you know, this is also be said, you may say, oh, well, maybe I can say it this way or maybe I can try it this way. But if you definitively know, no, okay, that is incorrect. That is not the right way to say things. That helps you kind of stay on track. Now, and you can go off and make new mistakes, right? And hopefully not make the ones you've already made in the past. And that's okay. It's okay to make new mistakes. And we learn from those, hopefully. That is the point of including lessons from your mistakes, is that you really learn from those mistakes. So that, yeah, you can go forward and make brand new mistakes and learn from those.
Right. And it's not that you want to know all the ways not to say something. It's that you want to experiment. And then you want to know the results of those experiments, right?
And I'll say for anyone out there who's still making the same mistakes, guilty as charged right here, John, we call that term fossilization, right? You've got some sort of mistake in the language and it's just kind of really stuck there in your brain and it's really hard to break out of that. That takes some real intentional work. And especially if you've got fossilized mistakes, it will take some deliberate practice and you really need to make sure you include some of those lessons and focus on those if you're really trying to correct that mistake you're making in the language.
And Jared, the ironic thing is that I think all of our listeners are listening to this podcast being like, oh, that's useful, and no one's taking any notes. And they're going to forget all this.
Haven't you been taking notes, John?
I mean, come on, who takes notes on podcasts? I don't think that's a thing. But hopefully one or two things have stuck for you listeners.
Hopefully. So next time, take notes. All right, now it's time for a word from our sponsor. And today our sponsor is
Mandarin Companion. Easy to read Chinese graded readers that actually makes a lot of cool merch that you can wear on your body to let people know you are learning Chinese.
That's right. We have a selection of shirts and sweaters and even mugs and patches and stuff that you can get on our website. And I gotta say, John, they're pretty cool.
Whether they're cool or not is up for debate, but the point is, they actually work. You wear this stuff, people will talk to you in Chinese.
That's right. Our most popular shirt that we have there is, again, 我说中文. So, you know, speak Chinese with me. And you just have this big thing on your shirt or a sweater, or you have it a mug, a patch. You can put it on like a sewn on a backpack, whatever. And it is a great conversation starter. We have gotten a lot of people make comments say, hey, this was great.
Yeah, this one definitely works. We've heard it from a lot of people. So if you are in doubt and you're not getting enough Chinese practice, that's a good one. One of my other favorites is the shark one.
Oh, yeah. I like that one.
The Chinese is 一切都好. Everything is fine. And a guy's getting eaten by a shark.
Oh, that one's classic.
So we have a wide range of designs here.
We got all the ones that say drink hot water. We got some of our most popular and favorited memes that have been adapted for shirts. It's a great inside joke for you and your other Chinese learning friends. Chinese native speakers, they see that and start speaking Chinese to you. So you can go out and you can get one of our shirts today for our merchandise. It's shirts, hoodies, and mugs, and some patches in some of the instances. It's on our Mandar Companion website. We have a link at the top there. It's a merch. So mandarcompanion.com/merch. We'll put a link in the show notes. When we do ship worldwide,
check it out.
All right, now it's time for rants and raves. John, what do you have for us today? Do you have a rant? Do you have a rave?
I have a rave. So when I was in Atlanta over the summer, you know, I didn't see a lot of Chinese, but there was this one part of the trip. We were in the city and we were by what they call the Beltway, and there was this bridge and it had graffiti on it. And I was like, wait a minute, is that Chinese? And I got closer and it was like this graffiti style, and it looked like Chinese, but it wasn't quite Chinese. It was like imitation Chinese in graffiti style. And I thought it was pretty cool because you could tell that whoever did it, they were looking at Chinese. Like, they were doing a pretty good job of reconstructing fake Chinese. I don't know. It was just fun because I like that kind of character play stuff. You remember I talked before about Xu being the artist who created lots of fake characters.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
It was just fun to see it in graffiti style in Atlanta.
So kind of like Chinese tattoos.
I would have to say it's better than that. But I have a picture of it. On my blog on Sinosplice, we can put a link to that in the show notes if you're curious what it looks like.
I am curious, John. I'm going to click on it now.
So how about you, Jared? Rant or rave?
Okay, I got a rave. This is something I came across recently. It was about the etymological basis for dongxi, meaning, you know, thing or stuff. Dongxi, it means literally east-west, but together, you know, it means stuff or things. And I'm always like, well, what was this all about? And so, you know, I'll just read this real quick. In China, the five elements are metal, wood, water, fire, and earth, which are combined with five directions: east, west, south, north, and the center. The east belongs to the wood and the west to the metal. Wood and metal can be put in the basket and be bought, but fire and water can never be put in the basket. So that's why we can say to buy east and west, but not buy south and north. Hence, dongxi. And I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. Yeah, that makes kind of sense. But then, John, I'm sure you'd have caveats on this, because then I jumped down the rabbit hole and it's like, actually, there's a whole bunch of other theories having to do with, okay, there's the five elements theory. There's the second one was like the east city and west market theory, which I don't even know what those really are. And then there's the east capital and west all theory. And then there's even some plausible thing about how the original character for dong is depicted as like a stick bundle. If you look at the traditional character and the long stick you put down on a cloth and you pull your stuff in and tie the cloth around the stick, which you can then drag behind you and carry with the help of a second person. And then the xi is originally the picture of a basket. So it's like those represented, you know, the dongxi thing, like things and stuff. But I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah, etymologies are a rich source of just crazy theories. I don't know where it came from, but I have this story in my mind. Maybe I made it up when I was first learning Chinese. The sun rises in the east and sets in the west. Everything under the sun is just stuff.
I like it, John. Just make up your own fictional etymologies of words.
Hey, I could do that. That would be fun.
My name is Nick Anderson.
Nick and I connected on Instagram, and after hearing a little bit about what he does, I knew we had to get him on the podcast.
I like to think of myself as a cross-cultural consultant. On top of that, I also am a dialect coach, helping actors that have lines in Mandarin feel very confident on set, portrayed as a natural language for them, make sure that it looks good on set.
Learning Chinese opened up a whole new life for Nick that allowed him to explore and discover who he was. The Chinese skills he developed have opened up career and life experiences that few get to experience. Stay with us. So, Nick, why did you start learning Chinese?
I was 18 years old. I grew up in the Midwest and took world history and was learning a lot about American history, but there was this very blank space of what was going on the other side of the world in Asia, and really just had no idea what was going on culturally, historically, politically. Nothing was really being talked about at that point from where I was growing up. So curiosity really drove me to start learning Mandarin and then beyond that move and live in China.
That's a bit of a big step there. Oh, there's a bit of an absence in the history, what I'm instructed of in school about, you know, China or Asian history. Was there something you came across and was like, oh, wow, wait a second, there's this whole part of the world I don't even know anything about?
Yeah, it wasn't necessarily an event that happened, although at that point had been studying a lot of Spanish and actually having a really strong command of Spanish. And when I was graduating high school, the whole discussion around going to college was happening. And my plan was to actually move to Mexico, find a job in Cancun, and just speak Spanish all the time. And my parents didn't really agree with that.
Imagine that.
And for good reason, right? And so my way of kind of rebelling that was, well, then I'm going to learn Mandarin and I'm going to move to China. I was a bit of a unique circumstance in that at this point, I was in the closet. I felt unable to really share that side of myself to family and friends in that area in the Midwest. And interestingly, Jared, going to Shanghai really held a space for me to explore my queerness and to come out. I was in a really safe space to do that. I didn't know anyone in China. It really allowed for just the exploration to happen, interestingly, right?
That's really interesting. I'm curious to hear a little bit more about this. And so I'm wondering, was this, you know, dealing with your inner identity, right? And I guess you're talking about some of these things about, you know, hey, will my family accept me? What will my friends think? Were those kind of forces maybe kind of pushing you to, hey, I want to leave the area?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And at 18 years old, what did I have to lose, right? Like, I was the ideal age to start preparing for that in a way. It felt like I was going to the moon, right? It was just a whole part of the world that I, again, didn't really know much about at this point, but also didn't know anyone and was really far away. And that distance, it was what I needed.
Well, I'm also curious to hear a little bit more about this, because I'm sure there are hundreds of thousands of people who've probably had those similar feelings as you, have been through similar experiences, but maybe they moved to the next city or they moved to another state.
I know.
You moved to China, a country you didn't speak any Chinese, you know, all this type of stuff. What was really driving you, though, to China? I get this, you're like, I don't know much about the place. I want to move outside of my comfort zone. Right. I want to get someplace new, but why China?
It's interesting, right? Like, moving to another city for some people could feel like they're moving to China in a way, right? Where it's just like, it's far enough for them. For me, I wanted to go to the moon, Jared. If I could have, I would have, right? It was really the furthest place possible geographically.
You're about right, too.
Right? From Chicago, essentially, right? It was the furthest place possible. The time difference was so nice for me because I really got a chance to separate myself. I was awake there and they were sleeping here, right? Like,
yeah.
Catching each other on the phone was not as easy. It really was, in a lot of ways, escapist, for sure. Just trying to run away from what I was feeling here to remedy that by allowing myself the chance to actually explore those thoughts and feelings. It's interesting that in China, I felt safe to do that. I think that's something that a lot of people ask me about is, well, why China in that sense, right? Why did you feel safe to come out in China? And I think that for me, as a white American, I had this very different experience in that the privilege of that really allowed me to feel safe there. Right. And so this is for context. This is in 2005. And I just remember landing, getting off the plane and telling myself, I'm just going to start introducing myself as, hi, I'm Nick, and I'm gay. I was just going to really go for it. And a bit figurative in a sense, but the idea was there, right? Like, I really wanted to meet people and just be like, oh, I'm gay, and I've been out already for a while. I wanted just to sink into it right away.
Yeah. How did that work out for you, though? I'm curious. I mean, I'm assuming at this point, you're introducing yourself in English.
Sure. So I had a bit of Mandarin background before going to study there. So I went to college, St. Olaf in Minnesota, and decided to learn Mandarin before entering the school, and did 2 years of learning Mandarin. Although landing in Shanghai, even with 2 years of Mandarin under my belt, I was messing up tones. No one had any idea what I was trying to say.
So a pretty normal experience there.
Yeah, exactly. But that's part of the learning Mandarin, I think, uniquely to Mandarin experience. Landed in Shanghai with enough of a foundation to really motivate myself to improve that. So I landed into a college, Huadong Shifen Dashue, East China Normal University.
Which is where John graduated from. Hey, it's a great campus. Beautiful place. Love it.
Oh, I loved it. I loved it. Really nice part of town. Really great Mandarin program as well. And did 6 months there. And like I said, I was out. I was meeting foreigners that were living there. I was coming out to them. I was going to gay bars in Shanghai. And Jared, this is in 2005. Mm-hmm. And there were spaces like that. I think that's a misconception that people were thinking, oh, it's really underground or really controlled or limited. But there was a lot of space, actually. And even a community of locals and foreigners that small at that point, but enough where there was kind of this shared experience.
I do know my time in Shanghai, I mentioned this on podcast before, my wife and I had a bakery there, but you know, we were actually involved a little bit with the community there. There was different organizations and stuff sponsoring different events. And so I do know it's grown in prominence, and I think that's a great thing.
Yeah, it has. I was just recently in Shanghai right before COVID, and I was seeing men holding hands outside. It felt like a very different world than what I had experienced, but it is. It's progressing. It's a very unique circumstance. The government is kind of ignoring it. I would say it's kind of like a don't ask, don't tell policy happening in China.
Yeah.
Right? Even on like the familial level. But in these big international cities, Beijing, Shanghai, you are finding safe spaces and community.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, I'm also curious to hear about your progression in Chinese. I mean, it's one thing, you know, hey, studying back in the States, but now, hey, you're in China and you're also kind of exploring yourself, right? You're growing and maturing as a person. But also, I imagine at the same time, your language skills are also growing. So maybe you could talk a little bit about how that kind of blossomed for you.
Absolutely. I am so glad that I made the decision to study and live there because of what it's done with my Mandarin. You are in a city where to do anything, you need the language. That was including opening up a bank account or finding an apartment, buying milk, right?
Like, yeah.
You really need the language in so many ways. I was really lucky too, because in my studying there, I made a lot of close local friends and we only spoke Mandarin with each other.
Really?
And that really helped to push my language in so many ways, right? That was where there was a lot of rapid growth. Interestingly, coming back from that experience, graduating from college in the States, and then immediately making the decision to go back to China, again, the motivation was to really improve my language. And I knew that being there was really the way to kind of fast track that. So it was a struggle in a lot of ways. And I messed up so many times. My gosh, when I'm teaching this language, my whole methodology is really based on how I learned this language as well. So in learning Mandarin, I always share with my students that the perspective we have to understand is that English is a language that's spoken around the world. And for that reason, as native English speakers, we're pretty forgiving in the sense of accent, pronunciation, grammar rules, right? We understand what you're trying to say. We won't necessarily correct someone, right? We kind of allow the mistakes and we can understand it. Mandarin feels very different to me because not many people are non-native speakers at this point. And so for that reason, native speakers have a hard time understanding us, right? With pronunciation, tones, all of it, grammar. What I found was to really bring it to their level immediately as a learner, in the sense of cadence, flow, confidence really plays into that as well. And then you're making it easy for them. You're taking the strain off of them. Mandarin is unique in this way, again, because we're limited in the amount of non-native speakers. So we have to make it easy for them. A really interesting way that I've done this was through building confidence in a kind of a tangible way, was to solidify a phrase, for example. It could be any phrase, right? And there's one phrase for me, Jared, that I will just like die with.
Oh, yeah?
And it's 这不是我的车,这是我妈妈的车, right? Like very weird, out of nowhere sentence.
This is not my car, it's my mom's car.
Exactly, exactly. I know. The cool thing about this phrase is that I'm getting a lot out of this. I'm getting this first phrase, 这不是我的车. I can take that and put it into a lot of different contexts. I can just drop the word car and I can say, oh, this isn't mine, or this isn't my phone, or this isn't my computer. We can kind of sub out words. And I'm putting it in a phrase that I feel really confident with expressing. I get also the bu, right? Bu is fourth tone, but when we're following it with another fourth tone, bu has to change into second. And so It allows me to remember that rule, which is a random rule, right? To remember with tones.
Yeah.
And so it's helping me hold on to that, again, confidently. Then even the second part is adding complexity, right? I'm explaining whose car this is. It's my mom's car. So then I can actually use that as well, right? 这不是我的, whatever it is. 这是我, and then whoever's it is. So I can sub out mama with 朋友 for friend, or 哥哥 for older brother, right? So like it just really allows for a kind of a substitution within a phrase that, again, I feel really confident in explaining or expressing.
That's neat. Well, I appreciate you sharing that. Hopefully it'll be helpful to someone listening to this podcast out there.
Yeah, I always encourage my learners to choose any phrase. There's a million of these that we can really use in so many different contexts.
Oh, that's really neat. Well, Nick, you were in China for 5 years, but you came home roughly, what, 2010? So what developed for you in that time, and then what kind of brought you back to the States?
I had left Shanghai in 2010, jumped around in Asia for a few more years, and was kind of in a place where I think a lot of expats that are in Asia come across, where it's, okay, I've been here now for X amount of time. I was there for 7 years, and I was in the middle of either deciding to continue to live there and find work and friends and maybe build family out there, or do I come back to the States? And for me, I felt that China really, again, provided this kind of space for me to explore and understand myself in a very safe way. And I was ready to come back to the States. That then pushed me into starting my own business in LA. I realized that not many people, again, were able to speak Mandarin, and I thought it was really important too. And I wanted to share it. I wanted to make this language accessible and feel not as overwhelming, potentially, as what people consider it to be. Beyond that, I really wanted to share my experience there. I think, again, we get such one-sided news over here around what's happening in China. A lot of people attach, well, what the government says is what generally the people think too. Mm-hmm. And I really like to make that known, right? That no, it's similar to here. The government is not always reflective of the people.
Sometimes I put this out, you know, in the States, we have about 330 million people, and there's a great diversity of opinion in this country.
Absolutely.
China, we got 1.4 billion. There is a lot of diversity of opinion.
The scale of that, right? Yeah. Yeah. And so I wanted to just kind of close the gap. It really feels like there still is a gap. in a lot of ways with just the geopolitics. It's really becoming more construed in a way, but it's still important for me to not only share my experience, but to teach Mandarin.
Yeah. Well, I know how a lot of times business things start. It's not oftentimes, hey, we have this idea, but how did you actually get into starting your business? And they said you're doing cross-cultural consulting. It's not like you went to one of these tech companies once to say, hire me, right? And they're like, okay, sure. So tell me how you kind of got into this and also into the accent coaching, that type of stuff.
Something I think for people to understand when it comes to Mandarin too, and again, I feel like this is really unique to Mandarin, is that it really actually opens up quite a lot of opportunities, things that I didn't even expect. And so that put me into moving to LA and starting my own business. I came to LA, I was late 20s, I have all of this experience in Asia. I really had a lot of culture shock in coming back to the States after being gone for so long.
That's a real thing. Reverse culture shock.
Unreal. Unreal. I don't know. It was a bit maybe naive of myself, but unexpected to have kind of a rough transition back to the States. I was looking for work and I had experience teaching Mandarin for my last few years in Shanghai. And then that was kind of what I was doing in Singapore and in Hong Kong as well. And so I just had that experience, wanted to continue that, and it just kind of started slowly growing in LA. As far as getting into the tech sector, I started with a video game company called Riot Games. They make a video game called League of Legends.
Yeah.
And that was really, Jared, just the timing of me being in LA. This is now 2012, 2013. And Riot was just absorbed by Tencent, which is this massive, I don't even know how to explain it, telecommunications.
They owned what QQ that went into WeChat and a gazillion other things, right?
Oh my gosh, right.
Yeah.
So the timing of that really found me in a spot where someone that was an executive working at Riot was looking for Mandarin lessons for an upcoming business trip. And came across my business, came in, and I was working with them. And it just kind of created this experience of not only working with them, but then working with a lot of people that were needing the language. And it's really interesting when it comes to, well, are they doing meetings in Mandarin? Are they giving presentations in Mandarin? I don't think that's necessary. I think a familiarity with Mandarin, if you're going to be doing business in China, is what's necessary. And the reason for that is because a lot of people speak English, there's translators, and all of that works really well. But what you're doing is you're kind of taking the relationship to a bit of a different level and showing more of an interest and appreciation. And I think from the Chinese perspective, that's really welcomed. I mean, for you to be speaking Mandarin, I've always had such an enthusiastic response to that.
Yeah.
And I also find that from a native English speaker, to understand Mandarin and have a foundation of it allows them to actually understand more so how their counterparts are speaking English, right? So native Mandarin speakers speaking English, we're understanding, oh, that's how they're kind of directly translating it from this phrase. So it doesn't, the lost in translation begins to fade away. Mm-hmm. Having meetings, giving presentation, I always like to encourage learners to introduce themselves in Mandarin, even just to kind of start off on the right foot. I think it makes a really big impact. And again, takes a little bit of the pressure off for our counterparts to almost have this expectation that this meeting, this conference is going to be happening entirely in English, mm-hmm. right? I think we have a bit of a responsibility now to change that dynamic.
Can you think of any specific stories or experiences where you really, I guess, helped ease a cultural barrier or paced over or resolve some sort of lingering issue that had occurred between some of your clients?
I had an executive client, also at Riot Games, who was going over to Shenzhen, where Tencent's headquartered, and was giving a presentation around security. And I think that's a really interesting space, right? With China and the US. He wanted to start his presentation in Mandarin and kind of just go through the basics of introing himself, sharing what the topic will be for his presentation in Mandarin as well, but then just kind of segue into English from that. We decided to integrate an idiom into his intro. As you know, idioms in Mandarin are, it's just showing the richness of the language, the wisdom, I think, even in the language. As you know, thousands of idioms to choose from. What do you choose? Again, the reason that this client was there was giving a presentation around security. And so we opened up with this idiom, which in Mandarin reads, 知彼知己,百战不殆, which essentially translates as, know your enemy, know yourself, and you can fight 100 battles without defeat. I unfortunately didn't get a chance to join him on this trip, but he came back mentioning how after this presentation, the amount of people that were coming up to him, he attached it to because he shared this idiom immediately in the presentation. Wow. And even saying it in Mandarin, right? I think that just pushes it even to another level. As you know, working in China, it's all about relationships and guanxi, right? And networking and having moments like that in Mandarin pushes and escalates even the building the relationship, but even more so, I think, maintaining the relationship.
Mm-hmm. I can really understand that. It engenders, I think, respect.
Absolutely.
Connection
that
typically can't happen in other ways.
Right. And think about what was not happening for, you know, several decades. Foreigners going to China and only using English and really putting this kind of, you have to know what I'm saying, right? And we're still going to work with each other. Now it's different and in such a special way. As far as dialect coaching, though, Jared, that's something that, again, Mandarin opened a door that was unexpected to me. And again, I think timing, location, all are elements to consider. But being in Los Angeles, coaching Mandarin, you're just connected into this entertainment industry. And it was through a friend that introduced me to an agent as a dialect coach. She's a dialect coach agent. So she has coaches for a lot of languages, Italian and Spanish, right? And at the time, this was in 2013, 2014, not much Mandarin popping up in TV shows, but it started happening.
Yeah.
And through this dialect coach agent, brought onto several sets for film and TV. Some of the TV shows were even, you know, they're 8 episodes long. And so there's Mandarin happening in each episode. So I'm really getting a chance to develop this relationship with the actors and actresses and getting to know them, and is so much fun. I think a very different way of teaching someone. They don't need to know what they're saying. They just need to know how to say it.
Mm.
I did a movie called Arrival.
Oh, yeah.
Amy Adams plays this kind of linguistics professor,
I believe. It's a fantastic movie. Really enjoyed
that.
Oh,
my God. Unreal. Such a good story. The way that Mandarin plays into it, if you can remember, is almost like the end of the film, but also the kind of pinnacle moment of the film.
There's the Chinese general there, and she whispers something to him, right?
Right. It was really interesting. They gave me a few lines to translate, and the lines changed almost every hour, it felt like. It was just...
Oh, really?
Yeah, because of the weight of that, they didn't know what Amy needed to say in that moment. And so it changed quite a bit.
Oh, so the script wasn't fully determined at the onset of the movie, right?
Absolutely.
So they're still trying to figure this out. What is this crux thing she's going to be saying at the end, right?
Right.
Wow.
Right.
Really?
And that's film, right? Film is this kind of wild industry of everything is changing, everything's last minute, and you have no idea what's going to happen. At least that's been my experience in it. Although working in this case, we're translating everything up to the day that it's being filmed. It's very dramatic, right? It's very like last minute. So we're changing these lines for Amy Adams constantly until we finally decide what she's going to say. I do the translation, and now we're on set, and Amy's trying to learn these lines. As you know, Mandarin, tonal, pronunciation, it's a bit of a challenge to pick up immediately. Working with her was great. It was so much fun. She killed it. And it was a long day on set, but such a fun, intense moment.
So you finalized the script the day before or the day of when you shot that scene?
Oh, Jared, like the day of, the day they were shooting, almost it was as if it was changing while I was going up to give Amy her lines. Again, the writers, the director are deciding such a pinnacle moment of the movie. It hasn't been like that in a lot of other films and TV shows that I've worked on. Things change for sure. We add a scene and things like that. But this felt, in the sense of even just the length of what she was meant to say. Mm-hmm. A lot of fun, very stressful moment of my life, but in a way, so rewarding as well, right? I watched that movie in theaters, and the way that it all came together felt really fun to see.
Now, I'm trying to remember what she said to him. It was something about his wife, is that right?
You got it, Jared. Really good memory. So at the end of the film, she makes a call. And she says, "Jiangjun, general, right? 我在美国营地, I'm at the American base camp. 将军,你夫人给我托梦了. General, your wife appeared in my dream. 她说你应聘智勇,凭借勇气来帮助拯救世界. You should help save the world with courage and bravery." And then she said this special line, right, that she kind of whispers in his ear, 战争不成就英雄,只会留下孤儿寡母, which is, war doesn't make heroes, it only leaves orphans and widows.
So that dialogue, was that given to you in English or in Chinese?
It was all in English.
So you had to translate that Chinese.
I translated up to the last minute in Mandarin, worked with her as much as we could, took like lots of cuts, and they made it into magic.
That's a sophisticated statement, I guess I might say. Is there any grammar or word usage in there that's maybe not accurate? Because I've got to say, even if there is, it's mad respect, I got to say.
I appreciate it. The cool thing is working as a Mandarin coach, teacher, instructor, right, as this cross-cultural consultant, it's really pushed myself into new areas with the language. And in this case, right, lots of new expressions and things, but that's what I've loved about this kind of work is that I'm constantly learning Mandarin as I'm going. Working in the tech sector, I'm constantly learning new vocabulary words and new phrases. So it's not, I don't feel any losing or fading of my language. I'm feeling similarly to how I felt in Shanghai, just this kind of constant growth and improvement with it, which I feel like Mandarin, that's the journey. It's kind of a commitment that you make when you decide to learn Mandarin.
Well, that's really neat. That's really neat. Well, I got to ask you though, you know, one thing that came out, I think it was last year or something, was the Moon Knight. It was a Marvel Moon Knight. And there was that section there was just speaking Chinese and it's like, you know, Shaka Shuda, you
know,
what the heck are they saying? What happened there?
I know. That's the thing, right? Is that now there are people that actually know Mandarin, right? That are watching these shows and it's showing to a Chinese audience or a Mandarin speaking audience. So they need to take this a little bit more seriously at this point. I know exactly what you're talking about. I was trying to decipher it as much as possible. I would rewind and play and rewind and play. I'm like, this is nothing here. There's nothing.
John went over this like an inordinate amount of time because he withheld judgment for a while. He's like, maybe they had someone speaking some, you know, local language and who knows where in China.
Sure.
But no, afterwards he ran it by all sorts of friends and people and it was like, we have no idea what he's saying.
Come on, right? And that matters now because now we all joke about it and we remember too.
Yeah, it does.
You know, there's films though, like Everything Everywhere All at Once, where this really interesting intersection of Mandarin and queerness. At least those are the themes that really stuck out to me, which it's just so cool to see what's happening and what the discussion is and where it's going. It's really pretty special.
That's neat. Well, Nick, what kind of advice would you give to someone who's learning Chinese right now or even thinking about it?
I, again, really want to reiterate how important Mandarin is in the sense of we need non-native speakers to be speaking Mandarin. As non-native speakers, this language is really difficult and challenging, and there are so many random rules, and there's thousands and thousands of characters. And like I said, I'm still learning, and I've been speaking this language now for 20 years. As a learner starting out or making the decision to start out with learning Mandarin, is to really just get messy with the language. And what I mean by that is to make mistakes with it. Mess it up, say things incorrectly, but just try. And through those mistakes, I've really been able to learn how to say it correctly. So mess it up, right? I get dirty with it. I think the fun thing is that as a non-native speaker, we really get to kind of break the rules of how this language is typically spoken, or right, we kind of bring our cultural lens to the experience and our communication, and that goes into Mandarin as well. And I think it's good for native speakers to really hear that different way of saying and expressing that idea. But to get there, we really just have to mess it up and not feel bad about it. And people will look at us like, what are you trying to say? And what? But that's okay. And it's really liberating in a way to allow yourself to just kind of go into it.
I have to wholeheartedly agree with that. Well, Nick, if people want to find out a little bit more about you or what you do, where could they go?
Yeah, great question, Jared. I have a few things. My website is mandarinstudies.com. On there, I have my Mandarin lessons that I'm teaching to groups, and just a lot of resources, materials for people. Beyond that, I have a Discord server called Chinatown. What's really fun about that space is that it's this kind of English and Mandarin speaking community. It's very inclusive and international. That's a lot of fun. We have different channels around food recipes and art and news topics that people really get a lot of discussion into. Also, just a great place to practice English or Mandarin. And I also have a TikTok. My handle is @queermandarin. I just share my experiences over my TikTok and make the language a little bit more accessible and just kind of teach a few vocab words and phrases over that as well.
Well, that sounds fantastic. Well, we'll make sure we include a link in the show notes so people can find you. But Nick, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me, share your story and your experiences. And it's been great to hear all this.
Thanks so much, Jared. I really appreciate it as well. It's fun to connect with people in this very unique experience of being foreigners and speaking Mandarin.
Oh, it is. You have been listening to the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. Help us spread the word by sharing this with your friends, classmates, teachers, cousins, cowboy, wrangler, auctioneer, footballer, illustrator, medical assistant, and the one gal named Jacqueline. Please subscribe to our podcast and share it with a friend. And if you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review. You can also reach out to us at mannercompanion.com or mannercompanion on social media. Apologies to John Cena, we just ran out of time. The You Can Learn Chinese podcast is produced by myself, Jared Turner. Our editor is Kaiser Guo, and our interview editor is Dominic Edgley. I'd like to thank our special guest, Nick Anderson. Of course, thanks to my co-host, the man, the myth, the legend, John Pastin. I'm Jared Turner. See you next time.